From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Bear. Today, Michigan is in the grip of another COVID spike. We're going to speak with a county health director who says getting out of this will depend entirely on people's personal choices.
We really need people to think about that, especially as we're entering the holiday season.
The source of these outbreaks may surprise you.
You know, the evidence that they see points to very little of this transmission actually happening in schools as opposed to outside activities.
Even so, as we'll hear, it's often Michigan schools who end up dealing with the consequences. Also today, what made Jackson, Michigan the birthplace of the Republican Party?
It had the infrastructure, it had the railroad hub to bring people here. And it had that abolition spirit that fueled the anti-slavery sentiment behind the party's founding.
Those stories on the way. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Bear. Today, election 2020 and why Republicans and Democrats might consider challenging Michigan's vote count this year.
I mean, if the numbers are close, I'm sure we'll have all kinds of threats of litigation or litigation, but I don't know what the basis would be because until the actual election occurs, I'm not sure that anyone could be very precise.
That's coming up later in the show, but first, this week, another 25 schools reported COVID-19 outbreaks. As we're going to hear later in the show, the situation in Kent County looks especially troubling. And these updates bring the state's total to 445 cases in ongoing outbreaks at pre-K through 12 schools. Health officials are telling us that a lot of these transmissions are not actually happening in the schools themselves. It's more often from social gatherings, sports, stuff outside of class. Still, schools are having to figure out how to respond. And parents and teachers don't always feel confident that those decisions match the level of risk. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been reporting on this. Hey, Kate.
Hey, April.
So this started when you talked with an elementary school teacher who was feeling freaked out, right?
Yeah, this was last week. This is an elementary school teacher. She is in Swartz Creek, which is this town just outside of Flint. And she did not want to go on tape, and she's asking that we not use her name because she doesn't want to put her job at risk. But she was really concerned, and she's having this experience that I hear from other teachers right now who are doing face-to-face learning. You know, this teacher really loves teaching in person, like all teachers do. You know, her kids were so excited to be back. But she feels like it's been kind of unnerving because it just feels like one staff member after another around her is either getting sick or being quarantined, especially when, you know, you're in a small school like she is. They've only had three teachers actually get sick, but it can feel like a lot. You know, she told me about like week three of school is when the first teacher, this really young teacher, got sick. She shows up one day to pick her kids up from specials, and then that teacher is suddenly gone. And then it's her partner teacher calling to say, hey, I'm at urgent care. So then this original teacher has to quarantine. She says it just all feels really unpredictable and disruptive, that she's stressed, the kids and parents are stressed. And the way that she put it was, you know, she just feels like the wheels are coming off the bus.
Jeez. So that's in Swartz Creek. What is the district doing for a case like this?
You know, they say that they are doing everything they can. They closed that elementary school where this teacher is for a couple of days to do a really deep clean. They closed the entire high school last week to sort of take a time out. They're also now requiring K through 5 students to wear masks inside the classrooms. But they're also, like every district right now, you know, they are in an impossible position. You look at the number of actual confirmed cases that they have. They've got like 16 total cases so far this year. And while that is not obviously ideal, it is really relatively low when you compare that they've got, you know, less than 4,000 students in the district. I drove over there on Friday and I met with the superintendent, Ben Meinke. And Meinke says, you know, the evidence that they see points to very little of this transmission actually happening in schools as opposed to outside activities.
You know, they're at a bonfire or they're at a, you know, a fall party or they're at a, you know, a family gathering and they're contracting it from grandma or aunt and uncle or whatever. We have three or four of our cases that are students that are fully online. They've never been here at all.
Jeez, Kate, I mean, what he's saying, that transmission isn't coming from schools themselves, do we know that for sure?
Well, it's hard, obviously, because it's not like, as everybody knows, we don't have comprehensive testing in our schools yet. It's not like every time a student or a teacher comes or goes from schools, they get tested. So especially for younger students who may be less likely to show symptoms, we could be missing cases there. But I will say that the officials that I talked to who are in public health, they are saying that the evidence points to really low levels of transmission within schools so far, often because these are places that, you know, are bending over backwards to keep people 6 feet apart and do lots of sanitizing and everybody wear masks. Of course, though, that doesn't mean that they don't get disrupted, because even if you have just a couple of cases, you still have to quarantine so many students and staff. You know, we're talking about Swartz Creek with what, like 16 total cases, but more than 400 people there have had to quarantine already just this year. One of the health officials I talked to is Marcus Cheatham. He's the Mid-Michigan health officer, and he says he has seen this in so many schools right now.
It's really the quarantines that kill the schools, not the cases, because you can have two people, one person infects another in school, but if they expose 100 people, you've got 100 people quarantined, and then you can't keep school open because of the quarantine, because it just might not have the bodies.
So schools end up almost bearing the brunt of this in terms of having to close temporarily. And then I see how this works. The parents have to change their schedules, and kids are dealing with the unpredictability, even if within the schools everybody's doing the right thing.
Yeah, and you know, we're just seeing this get worse. You know, we just heard from Cheatham, that the health officer, and he says, on the one hand, he deeply wishes that schools were not doing athletics and football, that he's seen cases come from that part of school. But for the most part, he says he was not worried about the behavior that he was seeing in schools themselves. Of course, now, as we are seeing cases rise in so many parts of the state, it may almost be a moot point, he says.
So now I'm worried about every school, every business, because I, you know, we're getting into higher and higher risk categories. And so, you know, we could be looking at a really bad situation here if the current trends continue. It would have, you know, it would raise the question of whether schools should be open at all. I kind of don't want you to say that, because when I say that, teachers unions in my district call their superintendents and say, we want you to shut the school down. The superintendent calls me and says, thanks.
This is the reality right now, you know, that we've got these cases rising. You're seeing this kind of increasing pressure, increasing fear. It often gets really focused on schools, even before, you know, the same focus is not necessarily put on, you know, churches or restaurants, or even just saying what, you know, he wishes is happening, which is that we weren't doing sports.
Well, we saw this in Kent County this week, right? The county issues a warning about rising cases in the community. And even though they said, hey, we're not seeing a lot of transmission within the schools so far, Grand Rapids Public Schools said, given this, we're going to stay fully virtual through the end of the year, in part because they thought the opening and closing and the back and forth would be too disruptive.
Yeah, and you know, you get into that really tough area of, you know, we know there are risks when kids are in fact in school, but how do you measure the risks of kids not being in school when those schools have to do what Grand Rapids is doing and what other schools have done and you know, shut down for longer? Ben Minka, he's that superintendent up in Swartz Creek. When he looks at this, he says, in a lot of ways, he feels like schools are the safest place for kids to be right now, both because there are so many preventative measures, you know, there's social distancing, mask wearing, but also because home may just not be a good place for every kid.
Some of our kids that come from poverty, they come from home environments that are not so good. And so everybody's concerned about COVID, right? So it's all about, well, it's just not safe. So how do we got to close school down. We got to keep people away. We can't have people come. That may be true for a lot of kids. But for some of our kids, it's significantly more dangerous and damaging for them to be at home. And this is the safest place they could be.
And I just want to add to that, April, you know, on what he's saying, that I hear this from parents too, you know, and not just parents where like a home is necessarily a dangerous place, but just places where they really see their kids suffering when they have to stay home. I talked with three different parents actually who saw this over the spring. You know, they saw how much their kids were struggling in online school, and they had the money to be able to put their kids in private in-person schools when their public school districts decided not to do any kind of face-to-face learning. And, you know, obviously private schools are not also, you know, they're not immune to risks either. But it does show you that for some people, this is an option more than others.
Kate, how are parents and teachers responding to all of this?
Well, you know, it goes without saying, this is obviously an incredibly stressful time. You know, the teachers, there's one I spoke with whose husband is immunocompromised, but she is still going back and teaching in person because she feels like that's where her kids need her to be. Others who are doing virtual teaching, you know, they're dropping off little gifts and notes to kids at home and waving from the end of the driveways just to sort of make them feel connected. They're doing virtual and in-person and 8 different types of modalities. And students have completely different days, day to day, as they, you know, do one day online and another day in school. And then their classes change overnight. And of course, parents are juggling all of this on top of work or being virtual teachers or having to put their kids in daycare or other less than ideal situations when they'd rather them be in school. And one thing that you do hear so often come up about this is that the political polarization that we see around this virus right now has really impacted these school debates on a very local level. Every single school administrator I talked to brought it up, that it is especially loud, they say, among folks who want face-to-face school and see it as not just damaging to their kids that this isn't happening, but that school administrators are not doing their jobs. One administrator I talked to, RJ Weber, he's the assistant superintendent of Novi Public Schools, and he is seeing this in his community big time. He talked to some colleagues in another town where parents are really also putting enormous pressure on administrators and school board members.
Certain parents are actually showing up at school board members' houses when they're on a Zoom call for the meeting to show their displeasure. My concern is then, does that type of invective, does that contribute to decisions that may very well be harmful to children?
So schools just feel like they are in a no-win situation. You know, it's worth remembering that they did not create this pandemic. As one health official told me, you know, it's not the school's behavior that worries me. It's the pandemic that worries me.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. You can see her reporting at michiganradio.org. Kate, thanks.
April, thank you.
Kent County is one of the many places in Michigan experiencing a steep rise in COVID cases over the past several weeks. The increase was concerning enough that Grand Rapids Public Schools announced on Monday they'll be finishing out the rest of the semester fully virtual. Adam London is Kent County's health director, and he's with us now to talk about what's been driving the increase and what to do about it. Adam, welcome back to Stateside.
Happy to be here.
So when we look at the graph showing the increase of cases in your county, it looks pretty steep. What's it been like to see that unfolding over the past couple of weeks?
Yeah, it's been very concerning for us. Throughout most of the late summer, we were seeing an average of 30 to 50 new cases per day. And here over the past several weeks, we've seen an increase to about 150 or more cases per day. And all that's happening while the number of tests that we're doing has stayed relatively flat and our testing strategy has stayed very similar. So this is an actual increase in the incidence of COVID-19 in our community. It's something we all have expected was going to happen as fall arrived. What's concerning for us now is that we don't really know how big this wave is going to be or for how long it will last.
What can you tell us about where it's spreading and how?
About a month ago, we were seeing large increases in the incidence amongst our college students. That 19 to 24 population was really driving our numbers, where about a third of all of our cases were in that small age span. However, now within the past several weeks, we're seeing an increase in all age groups. So we're at a point now where we can't really focus in on any particular demographic. It's really indicative of community-wide transmission.
Is it safe to say it's still a large group issue?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, we certainly see many of our cases linked to gatherings that are happening. We've been pleasantly surprised thus far that the opening of schools and face-to-face education, for the most part, hasn't been a significant driver of these new cases. However, we are seeing that after-school activities and group activities that are happening by all portions, all age groups, outside of the work or the school environment, are still driving a lot of these clusters of illness. And so we really need people to think about that, especially as we're entering the holiday season. How can we commit to consistent use of mask use, limited gathering size, hygiene, and really being smart about this, or else we're going to overwhelm our hospitals and we're going to be in a bad spot going into the middle of the winter.
Adam, do you think people are at a point in the epidemic where it's not that they don't believe that the virus is real, but maybe they're just feeling like they're a little bit over it? They feel like they want their lives to go on and that they can't just stop doing all of the things that they do?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. We definitely, I think we all are suffering from COVID fatigue at this point. And if you look back to how seriously everyone took this back in April and May, and the extreme lengths that we went to reduce our exposure. And I'm not saying that we need to do all of those things now, but I do believe that the literature and our observation supports the reality that if we had consistent use of facial coverings, if we had consistent social distancing, hygiene, and people staying home when they're sick with cold or flu-like symptoms, we would be able to keep this curve flattened and not see what we're seeing now, because it's going to be very difficult for us to undo this if our hospitals become overwhelmed.
What actions are you taking? As we've heard, the Grand Rapids Public Schools have decided that they're just staying online for the rest of the year. I'm assuming that was a decision that was reached in conversation with your department.
Yeah, they, of course, talked to us about that. And all the school districts here in Kent County have been speaking to us on a very regular basis. And the answer isn't always the same for each of those districts. Of course, Grand Rapids is a very urban environment with certain dynamics that make it have a different risk profile than some of our other districts. So we're really working closely with those superintendents to try to make sure that we do what's best for the health and safety of the students, the staff, and everyone in the community. And we're really trying to take advantage of the tools that we do have. And that's what's been so frustrating for us throughout this pandemic, is that we don't have fantastic tools for dealing with COVID-19. It's pretty unfortunate that this year, being a presidential election year, has introduced politics into this conversation so deeply. This really shouldn't be a political conversation. It shouldn't be rooted in people's, their association with the left or the right. This is an infectious disease issue, and it's an issue that we're all working together to try to get our community through this as best as possible.
To that end, the leaders in the state legislature released a roadmap for containing the COVID case count. And the Republican leadership, other than going through the legislature for approval, hasn't really proposed a lot that's significantly different than the plan that Governor Whitmer implemented through emergency orders. Do you think the strategy that the governor used was effective?
Well, it certainly was effective at reducing the number of COVID-19 cases. There's no doubt about that, that when we look at Michigan's data compared to other states, we did very well. And so there's no doubt about that. I think the question is, how do we balance concerns of COVID for other concerns of community wellness and try to chart a course forward that is mindful of all of the pros and cons and the consequences of this pandemic, in addition to the effects of the virus itself? And that's where this gets very complicated. But there's no doubt that the governor's actions dramatically reduced the incidence of COVID-19 over the course of the last 6 months.
Adam London, he's Kent County's health director. Thanks so much for your time today, Adam.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Michigan's once again at the center of national attention as an election swing state. Within that identity, though, we're in a pretty unique position in the political landscape because of our history. This was the place where the world first discovered so-called Reagan Democrats in Macomb County. Michigan also produced President Gerald Ford. And the unions that built up in Detroit cemented the relevancy both of Michigan and of the labor union in national politics. As if that weren't enough, did you know Michigan was also the site of the first ever Republican convention? Some would say the birthplace of the Republican Party of Abraham Lincoln. Here with us to talk about this political history of Jackson County is Linda Hass, the author of Hidden History of Jackson County. Linda, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. I am so glad to be with you today.
So what was Jackson County, Michigan like in the 1850s?
Well, you would be surprised to know that it was one of the more popular cities in Michigan. I think it was the fourth most populous. It was a bit of a hub because it was centrally located, just right on down the meridian of the state. It had a very popular train depot here that brought lots of people in. It was just a thriving town, mostly rural, but I think it had more infrastructure than a lot of other towns, even Lansing at that point in the mid-1800s.
I understand it had some connections with the Underground Railroad?
It had quite a few connections. In fact, it was a real hot spot in the Underground Railroad for some of the reasons that I mentioned as well. It was just a perfect stopping midway point, one of the most popular routes in southern Michigan along the Underground Railroad was from the western part of the state in Cass County, Cassopolis in particular, to Detroit. And Detroit was a launching pad to Canada, which was the ultimate destination. But Jackson was smack dab in the center. So if you were looking for a place to rest and recuperate, Jackson was the spot. And there were lots of safe houses in different townships within Jackson County. And that really is my specialty, investigating those.
Do you have an idea of what the Black population of Jackson County was back then?
I don't have any specific demographics, but I do know that there were a lot of Blacks that chose to remain in Jackson rather than go on to Canada. In fact, I've researched the family of one, a barber who escaped to Jackson on the Underground Railroad. His name was Richard Nicholas. And rather than go on to Canada or even Detroit, he stayed in Jackson. And to this day, he has three great-great-granddaughters that are still in Jackson, and I've had the pleasure of connecting with them as well. But I would like to actually look into that specific question. Maybe that'll be another book sometime.
Right. Well, why was it that this was the place that attracted the first Republican National Convention?
You know, I think that there were no other towns that were contenders for a convention of this size. And because Jackson was the fourth largest population in the state, it had the infrastructure, it had the railroad hub to bring people here. It was centrally located. And it had that abolition spirit that fueled the anti-slavery sentiment behind the party's founding. It also had a group of editors that was very dedicated to promoting this convention here and circulating announcements about it.
What would have been the size of a political convention at that time? We tend to think of them as quite well attended and very populous, but is that what we would have been talking about in the 1850s?
Well, actually, Jackson's convention was very unusual in size for that time. Jackson's convention drew between 5,000 to 10,000 people from around the Midwest. So it was quite earth-shaking at that time, probably larger than your average convention. But like I said, the anti-slavery sentiment was so strong that people came from train, they came on horseback, they came on foot in wagons. So it was one of the larger conventions. In fact, it overflowed the town hall that was scheduled to receive people, and they had to adjourn to an open oak grove that was large enough to hold everyone. Fortunately, the weather permitted.
I mean, it must have really turned into like a tent and an open air kind of event, given the constraints of what the town could have handled at that time, even being the hub that it was.
It absolutely was. In fact, there's kind of a funny story about the original gathering, which was scheduled for the town hall. And town hall could accommodate maybe a couple hundred people. And there were so many thousands outside that were so irritated they couldn't get in, that they were shouting and demanding and pounding on the windows and the doors. And finally, they adjourned and just walked a mile and a half north to an open oak grove and hastily assembled a platform where the speakers talked and the crowds could gather. And it was a beautiful summer day, according to accounts, and just kind of earth shaking in it, the ramifications afterwards.
What was the political mood in Jackson at that time?
In Jackson, the political mood was predominantly anti-slavery and abolitionist in particular. And I think it's because we had so many Underground Railroad activists. Several of them, in fact, were editors of the papers here, and they were promoting their views. It wasn't unanimously anti-slavery. There was a rival paper that was pro-slavery, and there was a fraction of the population that embraced that view as well. But I would say for the most part, the population was anti-slavery. And the mood was almost revolutionary. They were ready to, well, if you look at the planks of the early Republican Party, one of the planks was the willingness to take up arms when there were slave raids into Michigan's territory, into Jackson. One of the planks was the willingness to take up arms to defend themselves. So I would say that the mood was almost revolutionary.
So I understand that the title of birthplace of the Republican Party is vested in large part on this convention.
Yes.
But that term has been somewhat in dispute. Can you explain sort of who Jackson is at odds with in this?
Absolutely. Well, certainly that's one of the things that Jackson is known for. It's claimed to be the birthplace of the Republican Party. The only problem is Ripon, Wisconsin makes the same claim, and they both can't be true. So I decided to look into it. And Ripon's claim has one thing going for it, chronology. Its gathering occurred in March of 1854, and Jackson's gathering occurred 4 months later in July of 1854. So if you're going by dates alone, Ripon's claim certainly has the edge. But I contend that the substance of what happened on that date is more important than when it happened. So looking at the substance of Ripon's meeting, you have a couple dozen townsfolk meeting in a schoolhouse and agreeing to be called Republicans. Lacking, however, were the essential qualifications of a viable political party. You know, for example, they didn't produce an official platform that explains what the party is all about, and they didn't produce candidates to vote for. So, I mean, just imagine trying to convince an American electorate that you have a legitimate party without offering any candidates to vote for, you know, especially in a society where voting is a hallmark of our democracy. Jackson's gathering, on the other hand, drew between 5,000 to 10,000 people from around the Midwest. It produced an official platform. It produced candidates to vote for. And to top it off, Ripon's own application to the National Register of Historic Places states, and I've got this memorized, in fairness to the Jackson Assembly, it would seem that the elements of a party phenomenon, including nominees for office and the adoption of a platform, are more clearly evident in the Jackson meeting. So I would think that a good lawyer could maybe rest his or her case right there. But I think when Ripon claims to be the birthplace of the Republican Party, it's going on perhaps being the first to promote the concept or to be a forerunner of it. But definitely the phenomenon of any kind of an official party is absolutely lacking. Jackson's birthplace actually brought forth something physical, something tangible, candidates, a platform. So, I mean, I don't think either place is going to relinquish their claim to be the birthplace of the Republican Party, but they both played an important role, different roles, maybe members of the same team, but in different ways.
What would you call some of the other informative events that shaped Jackson County politically over the years?
I think our population at that time had a large influx of New Englanders. That's the largest demographic, if you look at the people that came to Jackson when Michigan was still a territory. And they brought with them a certain philosophy, a certain maybe liberal philosophy when it came to slavery. And this produced quite a few editors. Actually, and here's something that most people don't realize and that I brought out in my book, Jackson was the birthplace of the first abolition newspaper in Michigan. This is a state first. This is not just a city first. And I think that the newspapers here promoted that viewpoint very effectively. They pounded it out in their editorials, in their columns. They reinforced it. And I think that that sentiment helped to, shall we say, just reinforce that sentiment for a lot of people here, leading to the anti-slavery kind of fervor that produced the Republican Party.
Linda, where can the book be found?
Well, Jackson folks could get the book at the Book Cottage locally. They can also get it online just by Googling The Hidden History of Jackson County, Arcadia. It's published by History Press, which is a branch of Arcadia. And it looks really at, it has about 70 stories that cover all 19 townships in Jackson County as well as the city. So there's a little something of everything. And the point of it is to look behind the scenes at the stories, the amusing, interesting, or unusual stories that don't get told in the official history books, just to tell some of those and to share them with readers.
Linda Hass is the author of Hidden History of Jackson County. Linda, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for the interview.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. State and elections officials in Michigan have been warning voters for several months now that it's very possible we won't know the outcome of the presidential election and all the down ballot races on election night. That night is now just 2 weeks away. Beyond that, there have been reports that Republican and Democratic attorneys are gearing up for prolonged legal battles over election results and vote totals in individual states. We wanted to hear a little bit more about what might be in the works and how election challenges play out. Joining us today are Mark Brewer. He's an elections attorney and former state Democratic Party chair for Michigan. Mark Brewer, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
We're also talking with John Peerich. He's a retired elections attorney who has worked for many clients and many causes, including several prominent Republican cases. John, good to have you back as well.
Good morning, April.
Now, in case anybody's wondering why we booked this segment, I want to call attention to a pair of websites that went live not too long ago. There's one called Democracy Docket that is funded and maintained by progressive causes that counts the number of active cases about elections and vote tabulation, counts it at 31 active cases right now. I think, Mark Brewer, that might actually be a very conservative and narrow estimate, do you think?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I can think of several that are still alive here in Michigan as we speak.
Yeah, for sure. And then there's another website called protectthevote.com. And right on the front page, there's a message that the RNC and the Trump campaign are aggressively fighting back against the Democrats' assault on the integrity of our elections. In case anybody wonders why this is a thing, there's definitely a mobilization effort on right now. And I just wanted to ask you both, for starters, what's different about this year? John, would you begin?
What's different about this year? Let's see, 2020, I think everything's different about this year. But I don't think the actual election process is different. I think the safeguards that we have in place, the process and procedures that we have in place, are the same or better than they've ever been. And I think there's a lot of hyperbole that's been mouthed over the last 60, 90, 120 days about all of the infirmities that we have. But the reality is most of those are either creations of fiction or not based in fact and reality. So I don't know in terms of the actual election process, anything's different other than in Michigan now we have the right to have mail-in voting that we didn't have previously other than in limited cases, age and availability in the jurisdiction. But otherwise, that's probably the only major difference. The number of people who have either received a ballot by mail or gone to their clerk's office and have actually voted. I think we're over 1.5 million people who've already voted in the state of Michigan at this point.
Yeah, it's not just a question of having the ability to vote absentee on demand, but because of the pandemic, many people are thinking about the safety of going to their local polling place. And
yeah, absolutely.
Already more than 1 million people have submitted their votes by mail, according to the Secretary of State's count. Mark Brewer, how would you answer that question? What's different in 2020?
Well, I certainly agree with John, but I think the system is under unusual stress because of the pandemic and because what's going to be record turnout here in Michigan. I think our clerks have generally done a very good job adapting to Proposal 3 and the no reason absentee voting. But that is different in terms of volume. John's right. There's been no change in process, but the volume is extraordinary and is testing folks. We're also seeing litigation about what exactly does Proposal 3 mean? And there have been a number of cases here about its contours. So I think those are the things that I would see as different this time.
Yeah. The term ballot harvesting has come up a lot lately. It's right there on the front page of protectthevote.com. John Peerich, could you, we've talked with you about this before. What does ballot harvesting mean?
Well, ballot harvesting typically and historically in jurisdictions has meant people who go and to certain facilities or certain locales and help people in the process of voting who might otherwise not be able to. So maybe the best example is nursing homes. A lot of entities actually go to nursing homes and assist with the process of making sure that people who want to get the ballot get it, and number two, that they exercise their right to vote, and then they help then transmit the materials in a safe and a proper fashion back to the election officials. So it's not a new phenomenon. It's just been given all kinds of pejorative kinds of assessments in this era that, for the most part, are really unrealistic.
I have to say, I lived for a lot of years in Oregon, which is entirely a vote-by-mail state. And I was a little chagrined when I started seeing this term pop up. It was not unusual at all to have, like, someone in the workplace say, hey, I'm going past the Board of Elections. Anybody have a ballot I can drop off for you? But this, how much of the concern over ballot harvesting, I want to ask either of you who cares to answer, how much of the concern over ballot harvesting is really important to pay attention to right now?
I think in Michigan that it's really not a concern. The activity you just described in Oregon would be illegal in Michigan unless that person was a member of the family or a government official. We've had very strict rules here about who can handle a voted or unvoted absentee ballot for a long, long time. So this has not been, I think, a problem here in Michigan. The law does allow, as John indicated, assistance in the process of obtaining an application, you know, returning an application and so forth. But the law is very strict on who can handle a ballot.
Right. Let's talk a little bit more about active cases in Michigan. I'd like to ask both of you about ones that you are watching. Mark Brewer, could you tell us which ones are on your mind?
Yes. I think chiefly the case that was decided last week by the Court of Appeals, which disallowed the return of absentee ballots later than 8 p.m. on election day. There have been a number of cases brought to seek to extend that time that say, look, if it's postmarked by election day, it should be counted if it's received within a few days thereafter. And the origin of those cases are concerned about the pandemic. And then that was exacerbated this summer when we learned that the post office was having processing problems for whatever reason. But unfortunately, it appears we're on a path here in Michigan that the courts are not going to allow that to happen. And voters will have to get their absentee ballots back by 8 o'clock on election day if they're to be counted.
That's, I think, the most important case that's out there. And I do agree with Mark that this was really much more pandemically related with regard to the process and procedures for obtaining ballots back to the clerk's office in a timely fashion. And whether the Postal Service was able to do so came into question. I think the reality is, though, historically, our rule has always been exactly now what the Court of Appeals has decided, that the ballots have to be in the possession of the clerks by 8 p.m. on election night. And it was interesting that you probably noted that yesterday the U.S. Supreme Court in the Pennsylvania decision was unable to come to a majority vote, so the lower court vote stands. And I believe in Pennsylvania, the edict was 3 additional days if they were postmarked on election day. So I think those are the nuances of the pandemic are really the most important issues that have come before the courts. Some of the other issues and some of the other jurisdictions that I think we've all been monitoring and watching are efforts to restrict or to in any way, shape or form, make it more difficult for people to exercise the franchise, whether it's with regard to identification criteria that certain jurisdictions have, or whether it has the relationship with regard to the hours that they may have available in other jurisdictions. But I think the pandemic issues are the most pressing. And I would say based upon our earlier comments, the number of people voting early, not only in Michigan, and you know, I believe there are what, six states that send out mailing ballots to all registered voters. April, you mentioned Oregon. I know Washington does the same thing. The reality is we may get over the real health crisis with regard to people trying to vote on election day by the use of the early voting mechanisms that we now have in place. And, you know, you've seen the lines in Florida, in Georgia, and in other jurisdictions. People want to vote, and they want to vote safely. And I think this is an incredible way to do it.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is John Peerich, retired elections attorney, who's worked on several well-known Republican candidate cases and causes. We're also speaking with Mark Brewer, who's a former state Democratic Party chair and an elections attorney. Several news sources have reported that both the Trump and Biden campaigns were conducting early recon, talking to secretaries of state and checking in on what tabulation procedures would consist of this year. I want to ask either of you, do you expect that there will be legal challenges to the presidential race playing out in Michigan this year? John?
I don't know if there will be or not. I think it's going to really decide. I mean, it's going to be decided by what happens and what the numbers look like. I mean, if the numbers are close, I'm sure we'll have all kinds of threats of litigation or litigation. But I don't know what the basis would be, because until the actual election occurs, I'm not sure that anyone can be very precise. And again, I think this is part of this hysteria that's been built up about all the things that go wrong. Let's go back to what Mark said earlier. And I think it's really important. The clerks in this state, and I think the clerks in almost every jurisdiction in this country, have done a phenomenal job in terms of running elections year in and year out. We've never had any real major problems with elections in the United States with regard to their sanctity. They're run very efficiently. Are they run perfectly? The answer is no. You can't run an event two or three times out of the year for 10 or 12 hours and expect total perfection from everyone. Mm-hmm. But it's as close to perfection as you can get in a democracy. We should be very proud of our elected officials and our appointed officials who work for them on election day. They do a phenomenal job under incredibly difficult and trying circumstances.
Well, to that end, I think any Floridian can tell you, elections results tend to be trusted until you do have a close election or a hotly contested close election. Mark Brewer, are you expecting any major challenges to the tabulation here in Michigan?
As John said, we'll just have to see. I mean, this is always very fact intensive. Now, I agree with everything that John said. The preparations that you described are not unusual. You know, I've been doing election work in Michigan for several decades now, and both sides are exhaustive in their preparations, trying to make sure they understand the processes, that they have people in place to monitor polling places and absentee boards. None of that is unusual. On the Democratic side, it's probably bigger than it's ever been in my experience. But again, we're going through the same preparations, and just to be ready, to be flexible with what comes. And I've said this a couple of times, because the president will say anything, we have to be prepared for everything. And we are attempting to do that.
Should we expect poll watchers to play a different role this year than we're used to? John Peerich, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, number one, we have to know what the distinction between a challenger is and a poll watcher is. Challengers are people who actually can challenge an individual's right to vote and can, in fact, dispute someone being capable of voting at a particular precinct. And the state has not only very specific laws about what the rights of poll watchers, what challengers are, but there's a process and procedure as to how that can occur so as not to interfere with the election process itself. Poll watchers are a completely different category. These are individuals who are basically assigned to a public area and could include people from the media who basically do nothing more than watch. They don't have an active role. They're not permitted to engage in any of the challenges. They're just eyes and ears that can say, well, this precinct seemed to run smoothly the whole day. That's the difference. And the reality is, do we have many issues with regard to either challenges or poll watchers? And the answer is no, we never have had. many issues or challenges. But in terms of the watchers themselves, they're just eyes and ears that monitor the process. They have no active engagement in challenging, and they really are just basically watching, and there's not much more that they can do and not much more that they can say. They certainly cannot intimidate, and that's why the state has adopted very stringent rules with regard to balloting and campaigning within 100 feet of the polling places. You know, it's supposed to be an island of calm when you go in to vote if you're voting on election day at a precinct. And our state statutes and our rules promulgated have clearly identified how that process is to work, and it works quite well.
The country feels like it's in a pretty fragile state right now between what's been happening with the pandemic, the economic crisis that has followed that. I hear what you're saying, that our system of voting and tabulating votes is durable and tested. Do you think the systems could sustain and endure a prolonged legal fight, though, that might test not so much, you know, whether the systems work, but just test our method of interrogating them? Mark, what do you think?
We have to remember the ultimate goal of the system is to honor the will of the voters. You know, we are a democracy, and all of these safeguards and procedures are set up to ensure that happens, and that it happens in a transparent way where everybody across the ideological spectrum can observe a challenge, go to court perhaps, if necessary. But I think if we keep that goal in mind, and that we are a society that believes in fairness, we believe everybody should have their day in court. They should have the ability to question what has happened. I think if we keep that goal in mind, we will get through whatever happens after the election. And this is about vindicating and protecting the right to vote in Michigan's case of what may be 5 to 6 million voters.
John Peerich, anything to add there?
No, I completely agree with that. The reality is we will survive these challenges, and we will survive these allegations because our system is the best system in the world. It's been tried and true. And even though people may have suspicions, and most of which I believe are falsely predicated suspicions, the reality is the proof will be in the pudding, and the proof will be the outcome of the will of the people, which Mark has alluded to. Mark and I have done a lot of recounts over the last number of years. And the reality is you hear all these allegations about things that could have gone wrong or may have gone wrong. And the reality is, when you go through a recount, you see in fact, what the will of the people was is upheld in almost every single case to the mathematical preciseness of election night results. Might there be a one or two vote change? There might be one or two votes. But the reality is the system is a very, very efficient, effective, and I think foolproof system in regard to the will of the people being upheld.
People may be looking at poll results right now and thinking, well, if the presidential election is not that close, maybe I don't need to worry about it that much.
Well, I'll just offer this. Unlike, you know, in contrast to what John just said, and I agree with it, that our system is robust and it does reflect on the system. Polls do not do that. They are snapshots in time of an incredibly small group of voters. They don't capture dynamics. They don't capture changes. And if 216 taught us anything, it's that folks should not rely upon polls in determining whether they're going to vote.
The only poll that matters is the results of election day and the people who voted prior to election day under the means that we now have available. And I think most of us have great confidence that the system will work as well this time as it has every other time.
We've been talking with John Peerich and with Mark Brewer. Both are elections attorneys, John Peerich being retired from the job. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time today. And thanks for your thoughts.
Thanks, April.
Thank you.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Laura Weber Davis is going to be taking care of you the next couple of days. I'll catch up with you soon.